The Guardian. Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
At the heart of this debate, there's only one question or one choice. Do we, the people who live and work in Scotland, believe that we are the best people to take the big decisions about our future? Scotland's future is now in Scotland's hands.
He calls it a mission statement. Alex Salmond's roadmap to independence is published this week, but does it all add up? Hello, this is Politics Weekly, I'm Tom Clark. Independent Scotland would ditch nuclear weapons from the Clyde, scrap the bedroom tax, slash corporation tax, and raise the minimum wage. But its critics call it a wish list without a price list. Meanwhile, David Cameron vows to crack down on the rights of foreign nationals to claim UK benefits, a move that prompted an EU commissioner to warn that Britain risks becoming a nasty country. Joining me to discuss this, we have The Guardian leader writer Anne Perkins and the columnists Polly Toynbee and Martin Kettle. A warm welcome to you all. Now, it's been a big week in the Scottish independence debate. The formal white paper has finally been published. It's all 650 pages of it. And it's full of the SNP's offer to voters of Scotland about how things would pan out if it would go its own way. Now, Martin, you were up in Scotland for the launch. The document's very big. Did it hang together?
It's certainly big. Once you get hit with this document, you stay hit. It's heavy. It's got 670 pages. It has the answers to 650 questions which the Scottish government claim they've been asked. And it's
a question
pretty,
a page, is it? Then?
No. That's the second half of it. The first half is the lays out the offer. I mean, it's a good production number. But the big question is, what is it really contributing to the debate about independence? The referendum's 10 months away, and this is not, it's false to call it a white paper if you're being pernickety about these things, because a white paper really basically sets out what a government is going to do. But this is a white paper which contains lots of things which the Scottish government would like to do, and it's much more really an SNP manifesto in the event of winning the referendum and then continuing to be re-elected as the Scottish government. So, you know, there are a huge number of big and little questions. Big questions that stand out are: what are the prospects for Scotland's economy to be sustained by oil over a long period? What is the tax and spend regime that Scotland can afford after independence? What's going to happen to nuclear weapons? And will Scotland be able, as it claims that it's going to be able to do, to prevent privatisation, to retain a kind of common realm, the common weal, as it's often called up in Scotland? And these are the questions which, are going to be fought out over the next 10 months. It was an impressive launch. There's no doubt about that. It was a big event. But whether it's going to change the opinion polls, the numbers, I think, that's a little bit more doubtful. The trend in the polls has been fairly consistent over quite a long period. It's about 3-2 against the nationalists.
They've never got out of the 30s. No. Is that right? The yes?
More or less, that's untrue. There are some polls which, if I say there has not been a poll which has put them above 40%, people will write underneath this podcast that yes, there have, because some polls formulate the questions in different ways. But if you look to Professor John Curtis's website called What Scotland Thinks, that I think will tell you pretty authoritatively that not much has changed.
A lot of undecided, which is surprising on such a big issue.
It's not that big a number. I mean, really, when you think of it, I mean, they're looking at a turnout of 75-80% at the moment, and that's still that's pretty good by the standards of things. I think it'll be higher than that myself. I think there's a there is a battle for the undecideds going on. There's also a big battle for the working class vote in West Central Scotland around Glasgow. That's why I think the launch was not in Edinburgh but in Glasgow, because Alex Salmond and Nicola Sturgeon wanted to pitch it very much at West Central Scotland.
Where a lot of the people
working class vote. Lots of people living on council estates, not in great not in great economic shape, and basically feeling pretty vulnerable to a cold wind from the south.
I was in Easterhouse a couple of weeks ago and talking to people there, basically about that, but quite such a strong anti-politics feeling in general, that they were being done down, that the world was against them, that
Is that anti-Westminster politics?
Well,
or did it extend
anti-Westminster
to
anti-Edinburgh too, and I wonder whether, though, that doesn't translate itself on the day into more we'll have independence. I don't know that.
So you think it might be closer than we're all
assuming? I think so. I think there's a lot of complacency in Westminster about this, because as Martin says, the polls have always looked so secure and so strongly against. But I think it may be much more fickle than people think when it comes to it. Scotland, every time I go there, feels more foreign, feels very different, partly because they don't have any Conservatives. So if I'm talking at political meetings, political events or literary festivals on political issues, there's a kind of blank look comes over the Scots because they don't know what we're talking about anymore. You know, Tories, we don't have any here. What are you on about? And you realise that it does increasingly feel like being on a different political planet. And I think that may translate into, particularly if it looks as if the Conservatives are doing rather well and might win the next election, British election, I think that might make a difference too, what the standing is of, the chances of the Conservatives winning in Westminster.
What do you think, Anne? I mean, do you think it's one of those things where people are just so set in their ways, it's like asking someone to stop being a Catholic or something, asking them to become the idea of a separate country, or do you think that the sort of granular promises that Martin's talking about, or fears about what's going to happen at the next election in 2015 could swing this one?
I start from the grave disadvantage of not having been to Scotland recently, but it does seem to me a very attractive offer, and it seems to me to be why the white paper was so full of manifesto type promises. This, this getting to Denmark thing, this idea of creating a proper resilient and actually ultimately undefeatable social democracy north of the border. And it seems to me that's the promise that Salmond's making, the SNP are making, almost more than the kind of small print and detail of constitutional change. It's the idea that you can reframe Scotland as a permanent member of the Nordic community.
But Martin
is really winning.
I talked to some kids from Shetland when I was there in the summer, and they
sound as if they're Norwegian kids from Shetland.
They absolutely look Northern. True, these are sort of Shetland separatist kids mostly,
and they look
entirely North. They despise Edinburgh. As for Westminster, it's beyond their horizon, and they totally see themselves as Nordic, and their future is Nordic.
Well, I think Orkney and Shetland is actually quite critical of the SNP. It's not, I think if you can guarantee there's one part of Scotland that will definitely vote against independence, it's Orkney and Shetland.
Martin, we're talking here as if, as people often do, there aren't any Conservatives in Scotland. There are. They don't get the seats, but they get, 20-odd% of the vote. And then on top of that, it used to be the case that the SNP would be called the Tartan Tories. There'd be a lot of rather conservative. I mean, it's not true that everyone north of the border is a social democrat, is it?
It's certainly not. And there's a lot of rather warm and fuzzy mythology surrounding this question, in my opinion. The difference between Scotland and England in terms of attitudes is not as great as a lot of people, including quite a lot of people on the Scottish left, think. You just look at the opinion polls. There was one fairly recently, which was written up, I think, in the Social Attitudes Survey, in which people were asked, do you agree with the statement there's one law for the rich and one for the poor? 61% of Scots agreed and 63% of English people agreed. I think basically, attitudes are much more common between the different parts of the UK than they are very different. I think there is a bit of a mythology that Scotland is this kind of... This kind of Borgen universe in which, all politics is beneficent and so on. I just don't, you have to look at what the IFS said a couple of weeks ago about the prospects for an independent Scotland to just see how the The welfare settlement in Scotland is just as vulnerable as the welfare settlement in other parts of Western and Northern Europe. Western Europe, we face a challenge, a common challenge to a common model, and Scotland can't lift the drawbridge and pretend it won't happen there. Of course, it won't be happening in exactly the same way as it happens in other places, but I think it's something that Scots will have to face. And we haven't even got on to talking about what the impact on the rest of the UK would be if Scotland left, but I mean that is another big question for us
all
to consider.
One interesting thing, you mentioned the IFS. I happened to be talking to somebody in the IFS the other day, something that isn't in their report, who said, actually, no, I don't think that there is any legal reason why the Scots should take on any of the debt. Now, that kind of thing would be a game changer. If one jump, they were free. And of course, there might be retaliations that the Brits will put on them, like not paying their pensions. But that was to hear someone from the IFS saying that was astonishing.
I think there's an awful lot of untested assumptions in the white paper about how the division of assets and liabilities might go. And, you know, the trouble is that everything in the white paper is slightly kind of, there's a finger on the scales a lot of the time, and it's not quite true what it says about all of those things.
Can I just ask a procedural question? We've legislated for this referendum. I think the UK Parliament's had to legislate.
The UK Parliament, just to be technically correct about it, the UK Parliament ceded the right to the Scottish Parliament to legislate.
But will the UK Parliament would have to legislate again if there was a yes vote to enact that, or is it?
It certainly would, and that would be very, very extensive. And the SNP is
saying we won't pay the debt.
We've had a lot of negotiations recently. We had negotiations in Germany about forming a government. We've had negotiations in Geneva about Iran's nuclear capabilities. All these things take time, and they are compromises. And that's what would happen between the UK and Scotland. It won't just sail through in the terms that the SNP would like it to do.
But the problem is, though, isn't it? I mean, is that it's very hard to defend the status quo in the face of an alluring model of a better future. And I don't think that the No campaign's doing much of a job at getting out there and arguing in favour of the union.
I think historically, if you look at referendums, the status quo tends to do very well. So, I mean, I'm not saying that the state
it's
not an iron law, and it doesn't mean you shouldn't campaign, and it doesn't mean that Better Together shouldn't up their game. I think it should. My column this morning, I call on them to do so. But I think, you know, they're not doing that badly, and it is a more open argument than I think a lot of people assume.
Well, let's leave that there for now. You can find lots more on this debate at theguardian.com/Scotland. But now, the government has been accused of flailing around over measures to curb the benefits of new migrants from Bulgaria and Romania when working restrictions are lifted in the new year. Labour says the government is panicking, while EU Commissioner Laszlo Andor has warned that Britain is being viewed as nasty. Anne Perkins, this phrase benefit tourism gets bandied around a lot. Do you think there's any evidence that any of it actually goes on?
The government is repeatedly challenged to produce the evidence and to explain its claims about the costs. I mean, I saw one startling figure that said that every illegal immigrant, this figure was, cost the state £4,000 per head. And you would think, where did they get that figure from? Anyway, the government has never come up with substantiated figures to show whether or not there's any degree of benefit tourism. When they tried to do it in the NHS after Jeremy Hunt had made what turned out to be really quite inflated claims, they couldn't pin it down because it's not accurately recorded. And indeed, the prospect of trying to record who was a legal recipient of NHS care and who wasn't is a huge bureaucratic challenge, which probably the NHS doesn't need just at the moment. So the truth is that the point about the benefit tourism slogan is that it eats away at the really fundamental building block of society, which is a sense of reciprocity and the idea that they are coming here and taking our taxes is what that phrase is supposed to exploit.
And from what I've heard, Labour isn't challenging the story. I mean, it's obviously a kind of, at one level, it's a UKIP and Tory kind of campaign, but Labour's not...
Well, it seems to me Labour's really... I mean, I completely understand why it is where it is. The experience in 2004... which had not been anticipated.
Of the Poles.
When Poles and many other East Europeans who didn't have any restrictions on their right to come here and work, whereas the rest of the other big economies in Europe had put these restrictions on, did cause extreme pressure in some places on public services. And Labour is trying to overcome its misjudgment on that. And I think that the problem there is that it's shutting out any possibility of of framing the debate differently, because it's still trying to catch up on getting in a bad place before.
Polly, do you think there's we see Labour meekly going along with the government on this and just turning it into a practical story? Why didn't you get onto these measures sooner? But is there any point at all in trying to challenge it more? Do you think public opinion has made up its mind on this?
I think the trouble is that while there's any doubt about the figures, as Anne said, doubt about how many people are using the NHS, it makes it politically impossible. You have to have a policed border to your benefit system and to your immigration system, so that at least you know who's coming in, why, what they're allowed to use. And all of this vagueness is very hard to deal with. You know, if the NHS can't capture that information, how do we know that there aren't lots of people coming over with pre-existing illnesses who then use the NHS because it's much better than in their own country? And I think it's really tricky. I think any social democratic government needs to be able to say, these are the rules, and this is how we'll enforce them, and this is how you can be sure that only people who qualify get whatever benefit it is that you're offering. In fact, it does look... I mean, the NHS is slightly more problematic. It does look as if there really are probably pretty few people using the NHS and probably pretty few people who are claiming benefits within their first 3 months. Cameron saying, after, you know, you can claim it after 3 months. It does look unlikely. But until we get the figures, it's all quite difficult. So I think Labour might as well lie down under this one and, you know,
I think
would agree
quite
to these
figures on sort of benefit claims. And I mean, there was a misrepresentation about what is currently permissible. And for example, claiming job seekers allowance for more than 6 months is something you already can't do. And there've already been considerable tightening up right across Europe of these various rights and so on. And it just felt to me, and I can see why Yvette Cooper said this in the House yesterday, like a response to the bad polls in
well, I think Labour does realise they made a bad mistake, because after all, they did produce predictions of how many polls and others would come, which were wildly, completely wrong. And then they did nothing to about it. And then Gordon Brown kept saying what a wonderful thing it was, and it added £1 billion a year to GDP. And they were all over the place on whether it was a good thing, what was happening, whether they meant it to happen. Even when it came to building the Olympics, which they swore would be built by British workers, British jobs for British workers, it was built mostly by polls.
I still think we should step back just a little bit and remember that we have promises to keep in this area. You know, when the communist countries of Eastern Europe fell, Britain was at the forefront of the countries in the EU which said, we want to extend the EU to the east. Now, that was either right or wrong. It was, you know, there was some self-interest on the British side in doing that because we wanted to dilute the power of the integrationist project in Western Europe. But that was very much the view that people took at that time, that Eastern Europe should be part of the European family, whatever that means. So, you know, we pressed for that, and now we have a promise to keep about that question. And I think, you know, in the big picture, you know, we should be proud of this. We shouldn't be retreating into this. I mean, on most things, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. But on this, I think this is simply being driven by a right-wing lying press. And you know, 80 to 90% of this is a phony. And it's being driven because of a combination of a Tory UKIP
turf war
and a hysterically anti-European right-wing press, which is determined to do everything it can to drive the UK out of Europe, which is something that this newspaper and we should oppose at all costs.
It seems to me that it's much more about Europe than it is about migration, and the whole migration story is cover for.
Well, you go to Peterborough, let alone to somewhere like Boston, you go around those parts of England where, you know, what Thatcher said, swamped, that's how they feel in the Finlands. They do feel that huge numbers of migrants have arrived and they don't know why, and it has changed the nature of, you know, schools and everything else all around there. No accommodation was made, no sensible plans were made, no extra schools were built. It was haphazard, unplanned, disorganised, and, you know, we pay the price for that in the reactions people have.
Although it's interesting with say the health service, the other part of it is the workers. If you go into a London hospital, it's at least half the staff you think wouldn't be here without immigration, whether you go back one generation or two generation or more recently. And there's also the point of, on the other side of the ledger from the benefits about the taxes that are paid, because if people are overwhelmingly working, then as long as it's not illegal work, they'll be paying something, Anne. But that side of the argument struggles to get a hearing.
It's not often made, except in the columns of The Guardian. The other consideration, it seems to me, is the impact of drawing a lot of skilled workers from countries that probably need them. And I wonder whether perhaps we should do much more than we do, both in Europe and in...
I mean, can I just add, I think just one other thing to throw into this argument is that in this country, as we always do, we talk as though the UK is the only country to which any of these people wish to come. You know, that, you know, people in Sofia and Plovdiv and wherever are, you know, have only one goal, which is to come to
primary schools for
London
their kids
and
already,
the Fens.
Yes.
It just isn't true. I mean, all other EU countries of the North and West are having to face this question.
Well,
you know,
and to a much larger degree.
Italy and Spain have 800,000.
Italy and Spain, which in
workers.
Can ill afford it,
yeah.
are actually under a lot more pressure. And Germany is naturally the place that most people want to go for the simple reason that it's the most prosperous.
But at the same time, I do not feel I feel really uncomfortable when I see that Paris, Berlin, and London are all, you know, anxious about migration. I absolutely understand the on-the-ground detail that you talk about, but the historical sense that, you know, that there is a nationalist right exploiting this. I suppose that's really the
issue. It's not just that. Let's look ahead to the future. Just imagine if we want to take Turkey in, and I hope we do someday, because I really think that's going to be very important to show that it's not Christendom, as Giscard said. But the thought of taking Turkey in under the same freedom of movement rules looks unlikely. So if you have to wait until Turkey is as rich as the rest of us are, we'll never let them in unless you do change those rules. So it's up for grabs, that question.
That is true, but happily, for this argument, Turkey's economic growth is running at about 8 or 9% a year at the moment. So.
Let's leave the European debate on the rights of migrants there, because it was the EU's diplomatic corps that was this week celebrating something of a victory with a long-awaited deal over Iran's nuclear enrichment, which was reached. It's involved the lifting of some sanctions and the stalling of production of a bomb. And much of the credit has gone to the EU commissioner, who's from Britain, former Labour Minister Catherine Ashton, who, it's fair to say, Anne, was much maligned until just now.
She certainly did take over that job in a really unpleasant barrage of pretty sexist criticism. And she has beavered away in a very difficult job that she had to invent for herself, because it was really having a high representative for foreign and security affairs emerged from the Lisbon Treaty. So she had to take this basically one line in a treaty and turn it into an office. She had to merge various outposts of Brussels into one coherent body. But curiously, it seems to me that the fact that she is a low profile person, and that it was a very low profile job, gave her a particular power in these very difficult negotiations. And of course, what mattered most was that both America and particularly Iran were prepared to wanted to do a deal. But, you know, people speak with awe about how she managed to keep talks going when there was no prospect of a deal before the regime changed in Tehran, and how, and her tenacity and her skills as a negotiator, which actually have also, in a kind of rather unremarked way, resolved a, you know, a long-standing dispute between Serbia and Kosovo. And the people involved in that negotiation appreciated her efforts so much they asked her to stay involved in the negotiations as they, you know, work out the details of the deal. So she plainly actually has now, even if she didn't have when she started, a real feel for how to get, how to bring people together. And use the body language at the end of it, I think, from both sides suggested that she had played a really big
role. Her wonderful lack of ego. She does not strut about. If, imagine Peter Mandelson had got the job that he coveted so much. The idea that he would go around patiently, quietly, putting his own ego to one side.
Honest broker.
Never soothing, leaking. 27 nations who have to agree to everything that you say and do. It is a real... And she spends her time flying from one of these 27 nations to another, soothing people and persuading them gently along a line that, you know, it absolutely... But I do think we ought to say something else about to the Iran. So imagine that Britain and America, American Britain, had bombed Syria. Imagine that had happened. Would those talks have gone on? I don't think so. I think Ed Miliband has a role in this. Quite extraordinary that someone who's possibly a not very strong leader of the opposition has actually managed to affect world affairs to such a profound degree from what seems like a very weak position.
I think that's true. It's as much accident as anything else, but the cards have fallen in a very progressive and desirable way. And, you know, what Labour did over Syria certainly helped that. I mean, I don't think we should underestimate Catherine Ashton's ego or overestimate Peter Mandelson's, even though that's sometimes quite hard. part of the condescension, I think, towards Cathy Ashton when she started was a condescension that wasn't just sexist, though it certainly was sexist. It was a condescension towards New Labour. And it was, she got that job at a time when nothing positive could ever be said about the skills of New Labour. They were disparaged for all kinds of reasons. And, you know, the reassessment of Cathy Ashton, I think, is part of a slightly more measured view towards New Labour. Look at, you know, people's views nowadays of Charlie Falconer, who was also mocked and disparaged. And
I don't think many people disparaged him.
I think they did. I think they said he was just Tony's crony. And I just think, you know, these people are people of some substance, and they're getting a bit of recognition, and it's a bit overdue.
Just before we wrap up, Martin, can we ask you to bring us up to date on what's happening with the other grand woman of Europe, Mrs. Merkel, who seems to have a new government?
Well, yes, she has got a new government provisionally. It's a deal. It's the so-called Grand Coalition with the Social Democrats, whom she beat very decisively in the general election 2 months ago. It's taken a long time for this deal to be struck. They have produced a coalition agreement which is 180 pages long, rather shorter than Alex Salmond's, but this one's called Germany's Future, not Scotland's Future. And we await now the vote of the SPD, the Social Democrats, who have to have a Congress to authorise the party to go into this. A lot of people in the SPD are opposed to it, so it can't be taken as a foregone conclusion that this will happen, and that's partly why the SPD has done quite well in the negotiations, because the leadership, who clearly have to go into a coalition, need to be able to turn round to their party and say there's the stuff on minimum wage and welfare payments and so on, which, you know, you can rely on. There'll be a reckoning, but what Europe certainly needs is a German government which is going to get on with the agenda of the next 2 or 3 years. And so it's a good thing that this is happening. And
worth noting that it took 2 months. If after our own next election, will we need to scramble in that hysterical way that we did last time? Or will there be time given for a much more measured conversation? Will we get used to the idea, common across Europe, that you can take your time to form a government if that's what the electorate makes happen here?
Well, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to Anne Perkins, Polly Toynbee and Martin Kettle. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.